morning. Our first case is 9-2022 in the matter of the application of Columbus Southern Power Company. And our first appellant is Mr. Darr.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you.
Madam Chief Justice, members of the court, on behalf of the Industrial Energy Users of Ohio, my name is Frank Darr. And as we indicated to your clerk, we would like to split our time between IEU and OCC. I'll be taking up to about 6 minutes.
You'll have to watch your time there.
I will, Your Honor. The General Assembly passed Senate Bill 221, effective in July 2008, on the expectation that prices would be rapidly rising in the electric market as companies moved out.
Could you pull the microphone a little closer, Mr. Darr? I can't hear you.
I hope this helps, Your Honor.
Thank you.
The goal, as we understood it, was to stabilize prices and provide some predictability. If that was the goal, then the decisions that you have in front of you today from the PUCO failed to meet that goal. There are a number of problems that we have identified. Three are particularly important to this court, we believe. First, that the Commission lacked jurisdiction when it failed to meet the 150-day deadline on the initial decision. Second, that the Commission failed to hold the company's feet to the fire when it allowed it to recover under the existing decision without requiring the company also to elect to be bound by that decision. And finally, there are multiple issues inherent in the decision which render it both unreasonable and unlawful. There are specifically two themes that we develop in brief, and I'll go into those in a moment. As to the first two issues, we submit those issues to you on brief. They present very straightforward legal issues. There's not a whole lot that I can add to them. The other issues that I'd like to address for you today go to the problems that are inherent in the Commission's decision. Specifically, there are four issues that we identify in brief, and they raise two themes. First, that the Commission went outside the boundaries of, in particular, Section 4928.143. And second, that repeatedly the Commission failed to justify its decision-making in violation of 4903.09. The biggest and most significant, if those two things are separate, issue presented by this decision is the requirement that customers pay a POLR charge, or provider of last resort charge, of $456 million. The company had been previously receiving POLR credit under its rate stabilization plan. This was increased by 180% using a theory called Black-Scholes to value what was called an option. The decision was presented as a distribution charge. It does not have, the POLR charge was presented as a distribution charge. However, the Commission did not decide this issue on the distribution charge provisions in Section 143. More importantly, if you look at the decision at pages, 40, 39, and 40, and on the rehearing, at page 26, there's no explanation as to why all of the arguments against using the Black-Scholes method and demonstrating that there was, in fact, no increased risk associated with the adoption of Senate Bill 221, those are ignored. We are not, and it is not our intention to re-argue this case with regard to Black-Scholes and all the related issues to this court. Our intention is merely to point out that, for example, the decision fails to reconcile the fact that the risk of customers moving was essentially non-existent if the rates were as good as claimed. It does not address the admission by the company that it did not plan to incur any costs to mitigate this risk. And it does not address, the decision does not address, for example, the alternative means of valuing that risk, if it exists, and also mitigating that risk through going into the options market, the actual futures market for electric power. These sorts of failures are fundamental to the legality of the decision under Section 4903.09. Similarly, under the Commission's decision with regard to the OVEC charges and Lawrenceburg capacity contracts, run into two problems. One, they're logically very difficult to follow. On the one hand, you have a rate that's set at generation cost. On the other hand, you have an attempt to add on to that about $70 million of, on an annual basis, costs, which are never demonstrated to be used for that particular service. That's problem number one. Problem number two is the testimony used to support that inclusion was rejected by the commission as to two other plants and taken out of rate base. There is no explanation in the rate on the entry for rehearing as to why it was good enough to take it out in one instance but leave it in the other. And in fact, if you look at paragraph 6, which is what the commission uses for the basis of its decision, there's no discussion of it whatsoever.
Counsel, in view of all of the balls that were in the air, what's the bottom line that you and your clients believe should have been the holding of the commission? What should have been the outcome?
You mean in terms of dollars?
Yeah.
If you look at the four issues that we've identified, it comes out to about $700 million over the life of the plant, which is 3 years. Some of that is deferred, particularly if you look at the allocation of the generation cost between the two buckets that it's put into. Some of that cost will be deferred, and customers from the period 2012 to 2018 will have to pick up that cost through a non-bypassable charge. And that's one of the inherent problems with regard to that particular issue. The last issue, the GridSmart issue and the vegetation, specifically the problem there is with regard to the legality or the compliance with the statute, Section 49-2802D. That requires a cost-effectiveness determination. Here you've got a cost of about $65 million isolated that isn't justified as required by law and the Elyria Foundry decision, which this court issued a couple of years ago. I'm out of my time. If you have any questions, certainly Ms. Grady, who is also deeply involved in this case, can answer them as well. And I will cede the rest of my time if that's appropriate.
Ms. Grady? You have 8 minutes on your.
Thank you. Chief Justice O'Connor, may it please the court. I would like to reserve two minutes of the 8 minute time for a rebuttal. The issues I will be discussing this morning are issues of law of which the court has complete and independent power of review. I will cover 4 points in my argument. One, that the PUCO violated 49-28.141A. Two, that the PUCO engaged in retroactive rate making. Three, that Senate Bill 221 does not permit retroactive rate making. And four, that we seek a refund as a remedy. On all other issues, we will rely upon our briefs. Our statutory argument this morning is that the PUCO violated 49-28.141. Under that statute, the General Assembly established a starting date of January 1, 2009 for a PUCO-approved standard service offer, but it created a fallback or a gap filler provision if that deadline was not met. That statute reads that the rate plan of the electric distribution utility shall continue until a standard service offer is first authorized. It is this gap filler provision that the Commission violated, and here's how. The PUCO did not approve a standard service offer for the companies by the statutory deadline. Instead, the existing rates were charged to customers for the first 3 months of 2009. The PUCO approved this in two separate orders with no mechanism within those rates to balance or true up those rates once the standard service offer was authorized. But then, in March of 2009, the PUCO circumvented the existing rates and the law. It did so by extending the term of the new rate plan back to January 1, 2009. This allowed the companies to prospectively charge customers standard service offer rates as if those rates had been in effect in January 1, 2009.
And that amounted to about $63 million?
That is correct, Your Honor. The companies
were. What are you seeking in connection with that amount of money?
Your Honor, we are asking for a refund of the $63 million. The $63 million represents the difference between the standard service offer rates and the existing rates that was collected from customers for the first 3 months of 2009. We believe the PUCO's action violated the statute.
How does KECO impact that position?
Your Honor, KICO is a 1957 case that addressed post-appellate relief, and the appellees have argued that KICO precludes a refund. However, Your Honor, we submit that KICO should not be used here to preclude post-appellate relief because there is a significant factual distinction between KICO and in the case at hand. In KICO, the appellant was seeking the common law remedy of restitution and had not availed himself of the statutory remedies to seek a stay and to secure a refund pending appeal. Here, OCC and others took extraordinary efforts to preserve the refund issue on appeal. Those efforts were taken not only at the commission level, but at the court level. The efforts at the commission level included two requests for a stay, requests for an immediate relief, a motion for a refund, and as well as the efforts at the court. Two writs of prohibition were sought from this court. Several requests for stays and motions to suspend were filed. We filed an appeal early. Your Honor, we took all efforts to preserve this issue on appeal.
You didn't post the bond that is required for the stay, correct?
Your Honor, our stay was denied, and we did not post the bond. Yes, that is correct.
That was one of the reasons for the denial of the stay, is the inability to post a bond?
Your Honor, I believe that is what was argued by the appellees. I'm not sure that the decision of the court specifically addressed that when they denied the stay. But in any event, Your Honor, when this court denied the customer party's writ of prohibition, which would have stopped the retroactive collection, in its ruling, the court said that there is an adequate remedy at law available, and that is what we are seeking here. We are seeking the adequate remedy at law that this court advised us is available when it denied our writ of prohibition. Not only was the statute violated, Your Honor, but the PUCO engaged in retroactive rate making. This court has recognized that prospective adjustments which balance past rates and future rates are retroactive rate making. It did so in the Lucas County Commissioner case cited in our brief. Lucas County applies here. Here the PUCO balanced the past rates, the existing rates, with the future rates, the standard service offer rates, when it ordered that revenues collected from customers during those first 3 months of 2009 should be, quote, recognized and offset by the new rates and charges approved.
And that's what you're asking for, is the recognition in future rates, not a lump sum refund to customers?
Your Honor, I think that the court can be creative and can take that refund and use the existing ESP rates. The existing ESP rates are in effect until the end of 2011. And additionally, from 2012 through 2018, there are charges that will be collected from customers that are going to be deferred. So we believe there is a balancing mechanism within the ESP rates themselves, which would allow for the $63 million to be returned to customers. In Lucas County, and in Lucas County, when the court found retroactive rate making, it found that one of the problems was that there was no balancing mechanism in those rates that would allow the court to remedy the underpay or the overpayments. Here, there is a balancing mechanism in the ESP rates, and the court should use that.
Counsel, you're into your rebuttal time.
I'm sorry, Your Honor. If I may take a moment to conclude.
Sure, you can use it.
In closing, Your Honor, we ask that the adequate remedy of law that this court advised is available be provided. We believe that adequate remedy should be a refund of the unlawful $63 million levied against the company's 1.2 million residential customers. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Margard.
Thank you, Your Honor. Madam Chief Justice, members of the Supreme Court, may it please the Court, I'd like to reserve 3 minutes of my time for purposes of argument by Mr. Nurse, who represents the companies and is seated with me at council table. When the General Assembly passed Senate Bill 221, It fundamentally changed how standard service offer, how generation rates would be handled here in the state of Ohio. And let's be very clear about this. This is not your father's rate case. This is completely different form of regulation. The legislation completely changed what the companies must include in an application and what the companies can include in an application. The statute completely changed the process by which the commission must act on that application and completely changed the standard that the commission must apply in order to approve the application. This is fundamentally different than traditional rate making. Given that, and given the short time in which the commission had to act, I respectfully submit that the companies and the commission adequately satisfied all of the requirements of the legislation in approving this electric security plan. The commission had and properly exercised the authority to approve this plan. It approved lawful rates, terms, and conditions, and it more than adequately explained its rationale for those decisions.
Counsel, if we rule opposite of that statement you just made, and we do find that there was reason to reverse, the remedy that is requested by the appellants here would be an adjustment, either, well, to quote, we can be creative, but if we needed ideas on how creative to be, what would you suggest the appropriate remedy, if there is one available?
Well, I think in the first instance there are many different issues here that obviously could result in a reversal, and it would depend perhaps on what the basis of that reversal
is. If we use the retroactive rate application.
Well, I would submit, Your Honor, that if that was the issue, that there could be no refunds under the KECO decision. I think KECO precludes a refund. That was the statement of the court. The court basically said the companies must charge the rates that have been approved by the commission. They can't charge any other rates. That's exactly what the companies did in this instance. Consequently, no refunds can be ordered consistent with the KECO decision. They're simply, aside from the fact, Your Honor, that the retroactive issue is frankly moot. Those rates are long past. They expired at the end of 2009. They're no longer being charged. That issue really isn't even before the court. But were the court to reverse on that order, the commission might have to relook at the company's ESP rates. But the company has current lawful rates in place for 2011, and I respectfully submit that they should be entitled to continue charging those rates through the end of the year.
In his presentation, Mr. Dyer addressed the polar charges, the provider of last resort charges, and he suggested that they were inappropriate because there isn't any evidence to support them. What is your view in connection with the polar charges, which are part of this rate? Could you address that for me?
I will. Thank you, Your Honor. In the first instance, it's significant to note that the statute has certain things that it says a company can include in its application and other things that a company may. This is one of these specifically enumerated items.
I can't hear you.
I'm sorry, yes. This is one of these specifically enumerated items. The statute specifically says that a company can request recovery for a default service.
Yes.
Now, the question here is, what is an appropriate valuation of that default service? As Mr. Dar indicated, the companies already had some credit in place in their rates to recover. What's important to recognize is that that's something that the commission authorized for the companies that the companies had never requested and had never fully developed. So there's no argument that the pre-existing polar charges were adequate to cover the company's obligation to stand by as a provider of last resort.
Could I find the evidence on that? That's what
of the pre-existing or
to support this charge here?
Actually, Your Honor, the record is fairly extensive on that. The commission goes on for about three pages in its decision, and I believe it's in that pages 38 to 40 range of all of the evidence that was submitted with respect to the polar charge. And there are a couple of different things that are significant there. The first thing is to realize that the company does, in fact, face a risk. There are some differences of opinion about what exactly that risk is, but clearly the company's obligation to stand by to serve customers who migrate from its system is a risk that is imposed by the statute. There's no question.
Counsel,
that the company
is that what are we talking about here in terms of that risk? it would seem that it's not homeowners. Is it major industrial consumers that could change their mind that they've gone into the marketplace, found a deal, and all of a sudden that provider disappears, and so a big chunk of demand shifts fairly abruptly. Is that where the risk exists?
But no, Your Honor. Clearly, such a customer poses an extraordinary risk, without doubt. But that opportunity exists for all of the customers on a company system. Generation is a competitive service. Residential customers can select from a Crest supplier, a competitive retail supplier.
Okay, but
any customer could leave the system at any time.
What are the realities? My impression is realities are very few customers went shopping.
Well, the reality, Your Honor, depends on the market. And at the time that this case was being heard by the Commission, the market was such that there was not, in fact, a lot of migration from the company system. Those markets have converged over time. The risk continues.
Well, quantify it. What percentage of your load did you lose to competitors?
Significantly, one of the things that the Commission found in this case is that the percentage of customers who actually shop is not the significant consideration in determining the risk. The fact that the company faces that risk at any given moment with all of its customers is what constitutes the risk, not whether 5% migrate or 95% migrate. The fact that as competitive forces converge the markets, both the competitive generation market and the company's rates, it's more and more likely that customers will shop. And it's that likelihood that puts the company risk for providing
Bring us up to date. What percentage of your load have you lost to competitive shopping?
Well, Your Honor, I do not know that information. That information is not in the record, and I will respectfully defer to Mr. Nurse, who may have that information available. But clearly the markets have converged and the risk continues. And that's the basis for the charge. Now, the question of
the question is we're talking about $500 million, right, in this case?
I don't recall the exact figure, but...
And if it's a mythological risk, then that's a big chunk of change to lay on customers for something that may never happen.
It is, I understand that, Your Honor, but it is not a mythological risk. It's a very real risk. It's a risk that's imposed by the statute by requiring that the company stand by as the provider of last resort, regardless of customer behavior.
Does the design of the new statute increase or decrease or have no effect on the likelihood that somebody will go to an alternative provider?
Well, Your Honor, I think Mr. Darr was correct when he said that the intent of this statute was to create stable prices, to help open the competitive marketplace. It's yet another step in the evolution of the competitive electric marketplace. And I think as that marketplace becomes more and more competitive, the likelihood that customers will, in fact, migrate from incumbent distribution service increases, or incumbent generation service increases. So I think the statute does have that as one of its intents, to encourage customers to be able to shop competitively.
Mr. Margard, in coming up with this $500 million, it seemed that the model that was used, the Black-Scholes model, related to the value rather than the costs that AEP would have. Can you comment on that, please?
Yes, Your Honor, because it's difficult to quantify what the cost is here. What the company had proposed was a means of valuing the option that the risk that the customers migrating from the system essentially constitutes an option that they will, in fact, leave, that they will select another supplier.
That's rather speculative, though, isn't it? Is there any hard anything in the record that shows us hard numbers related to the costs to AEP for this obligation?
Your Honor, that's not the model that the company presented and consequently was not the model that the Commission evaluated. What the Commission did look at were the inputs into that model that were recommended by the company. The record indicates we believe that those inputs were, in fact, very conservative, that the numbers selected, and there are some hard number with respect to those inputs, that the numbers selected by the company actually helped to minimize
the value of that optionality.
And the statute, in your view, allows for this type of methodology to be used?
Absolutely, Your Honor. It's very clear from the statute that the other provisions of Title 49 do not apply in this instance, that the Commission is free to approve any plan proposed by the company so long as the plan in the aggregate is more favorable than a market rate offer would have been, and that's
precisely
what the Commission found.
Except the Commission could have rejected the plan, and what I'm troubled by is that the valuation does not reflect actual cost. And when you're talking about $500 million being passed on to consumers through a valuation plan that's speculative and does not reflect actual cost, why would the Commission not reject that plan and require something else from the company?
Well, Your Honor, the Commission did make some modifications to the plan, and what the statute requires is that the Commission approve or approve and modify the plan, which is what the Commission did in this instance. It did make some modifications to that specific polar charge that it thought made it more reasonable based on the evidence before it. It's important to remember that Senate Bill 221 and the whole notion of the standard service offer through an electric security plan is not a cost-based model. Cost basis is the traditional rate-making model, and it was very clear that the General Assembly intended to move away from cost basis as a way of valuing that standard service offer.
Well, counsel, was the method that was selected by the company and presented to the PUCO the only method that was acceptable in the industry?
No, Your Honor, I'm certain that that's not the case.
And
but
could there have been another method where one of the variables would have been the cost?
Certainly, if the company had presented a model that was cost-based, that's something the Commission
could have
considered.
They could have presented a model that was cost-based, because what I'm hearing you saying originally is that this is what the statute provides for, and in a manner that we're constrained to provide this model for the PUCO. But now I'm hearing you in response that there were other models, and there could have been a cost-based model that would have been probably result in less than the $500 million.
It may or may not have. That's one of the big questions. We don't know what that
model
would have resulted in.
Did you use it to evaluate first and then decide, well, let's use the model that we've presented and see what our numbers are there, and let's use several different models, and you pick the best one to present?
No, we did not, Your Honor. And the reason for that is that the statute is designed in such a way that the company makes a proposal, presents a plan. It's the Commission's obligation then to evaluate that with the sole standard of is this better than a market rate would have been, and that's exactly what the Commission found in this instance. Your Honor, I'd like to yield the remainder of my time to Mr. Nurse.
Mr. Nurse, your co-counsel has reserved 2 minutes for you.
Thank you. May it please the Court. I'd like to first address some of the questions that have been raised regarding the polar charge. The polar obligation is on the companies as a matter of law. It's not something that's optional to the companies. So as they provide a rate plan, the very beginning of that plan going in, they're obligated to provide service to the load that's there. We don't know what load's going to be there during the whole term of the agreement. It's a three-year ESP plan. A lot of things can happen in the market. So there's a definite risk of load leaving and market prices going down.
What's been the history of your load since this grand idea of shopping for electric and
there has been, going into this plan, there had been very little shopping. There has been increasing levels during the plan of shopping. But I will say,
modify that's.
It's single-digit percentages, Your Honor, but that's still a lot of
1% or a half a percent is a single digit.
Your Honor, it's not in the record. And what has happened since the time this the Commission didn't have the benefit of a crystal ball. They had to look at the best evidence and the projections of what would happen. And the polar risk is a function of how the market price relates to the standard service offer price. The closer those two are, the more risk of shopping. And so the evidence that was presented did project exactly in a scientific, in a robust technical manner, this model that's been used, Nobel Prize winning model that's been used for valuing options.
Everybody's been wrong up to now. I mean, the legislature passed the first act, I think Bruce Johnson was the sponsor of it back, what, 10?
It is 15 difficult.
15 years ago.
It is difficult, Your Honor, to predict what market prices will be in the future. But this
but
is just
I
like
mean,
an
in terms of shopping, it just never has occurred.
It's occurring more and more today, Your Honor, but just like an insurance policy, it doesn't matter if you make a claim. You're not going to get a rebate if you don't make a claim from the insurance company. The risk is there going in when you sign the policy. And, again, this is something that's very much within the commission's technical expertise. And they found
we're not competent to understand that.
No, Your Honor. I would respectfully submit that it's not the court's role to suggest, go back into the record and say there might have been a slightly better way to do this. The fact is the commission had specific statutory authority to do this.
What is our role then? Are we just supposed to bless these things when they come over here?
No, Your Honor. The standard of review is, as you know, is whether the findings are supported by the manifest weight of the evidence. There was certainly abundant evidence in this case.
Well, then that would require us to understand the evidence, wouldn't it?
Pardon me?
That would require us to understand the evidence if
it was, there's no question that this model was supported by Witness Baker, and while the other parties didn't like the result and may have, you know, suggested criticisms, you know, when it comes to the question of IU, for example, argues that we should have mitigated our costs, quote unquote, by buying these options and then passing the costs along.
But the difficulty I'm having is that the polar charge of $500 million was found by the commission to be cost-based, and it isn't. That's the difficulty I'm having with the whole concept.
Your Honor,
there
I
isn't
think
evidence
the,
of cost. It's a valuation model. It's a model.
It's a model, but it's,
so,
Your
so
Honor,
how do
it's
we
just
find
like,
that the $500 million is the evidence that the commission found was there to say it was cost-based?
Again, all the evidence shows that the value of that risk is exactly what the polar charge was established based on. And just like, you know, that it's a management decision as to whether they self-insure and take that risk and take the payment, the insurance premium that the commission approved, or whether they go ahead and externally. They could have externally entered into transactions, but there's absolutely no evidence to support the idea that externally entering into transactions to hedge those prices would have been a dollar less than what the options model showed. And precisely that was the purpose of the model, to show the actual costs that would have been associated with those risks.
So this is $500 million worth of insurance that the company is self-insuring?
Yes, Your Honor. I think that's okay. An analogy here.
And the company was, they had a whole trading floor over there, and they were trading actively and made a lot of money for a while trading these futures. And then one day they just shut it all down.
Well, Your Honor, you know, again, when you're dealing with markets, if you and I could tell what the market price would be, you know, you could probably make a lot of money that way. But it's not always the case. And I would submit that looking back to see what happened or how many people shopped is not appropriate, because the commission didn't have the benefit of doing that at the outset of this plan. And the companies were bound to offer these services at these prices for 3 years, regardless of what happens in the market and regardless of how many customers left or come back. And, you know, I'll point out one thing. I think customers have seen the value in this. The commission has allowed customers to avoid the polar charge if they agree to come back at market when they shop. And there's only been a very small percentage of customers that have taken on that risk themselves. They see the value in this insurance policy, and they've kept paying the polar charge, even the customers that have shopped, knowing that they have that option. They have the default supplier, AP Ohio, stands ready to serve them if their competitive provider goes bankrupt, if the market goes back up. They can come back to us at that price, and that's the value of the polar obligation.
Mr. Norris, the predictability, you're talking about the model that predicts the behavior and the value and so on. What about the reliability of the model or the linkage to what the company is actually paying for this obligation? That's the question that I have that I think we're all struggling with. The commission says this is cost-based.
Right.
But as we listen to your oral argument here, you're all talking about valuation of the risk, and the model was designed to do that, and we understand that. But the linkage, there's a disconnect. Is it valuing the risk and the speculation of what it's going to cost in the future, or is there an actual measure here in the record that shows, yes, this model is reliably predicting the cost to the company for this obligation?
Your Honor, I believe that's what all the record evidence supports by Mr. Baker in his testimony, that is precisely what the cost would be expected to be. Now, Mr. Baker testified that, again, this is we reserve the right to go out and buy these options. Okay, that's a management decision. But we're incurring the risk from day one of all these things happening, the unknown. So, the commission could have established a system that would say, company, whatever money you spend prudently incurred to cover this risk, you come back in and we can recover it that way and true it up. They could have done something like that. That's not what was supported in the evidence. That's not what was proposed. And the commission in no way is required under the ESP statute to have such a cost-based rate that's reconciled to actual cost.
So right now you're saying the statute does not provide for the fact that the company may have overestimated the cost or overvalued the provider of last resort. And there's nothing that would, later on, if it turns out the cost was much less, there's nothing that would allow the customers to recoup that money.
Well,
is that
essentially
correct?
That's correct, Your Honor, because even before Senate Bill 221, the generation service was market-based. And with market-based pricing, sometimes you make a profit and sometimes you don't. And again, there's no – that's the whole theory of regulation, Your Honor, that – it's emulating a competitive market. Here we have a competitive market, so that's less regulation. And again, the General Assembly, by design, made it clear that this is not a cost-based rate-making formula, that every line item has to be match up with the books of the company.
So if the commission erred in saying it was cost-based, you're saying that really has no consequence as far as
That's correct, that the statute doesn't require anything to be cost-based under the ESP rate adjustments. But again, I think the cost-based label comes from the fact that this was the best evidence of what the cost for these risks would be, and it's the best estimate of what it would be. But it's necessarily at the outset of the plan, it has to be established. Looking forward and anticipating what could happen during this long three-year plan and the volatility of the market prices, a lot of things can happen.
Council, was there a request for or opposition to this plan by the appellants initially when it was first announced?
By the plan as a whole or by the Black Scholes? I'm sorry.
Did they challenge this? According to statute, appropriately. I know that they didn't provide the bond for the stay.
Your Honor, regarding I don't know if you're getting into the retroactivity issues, and I would say, Your Honor, that as Mr. Margard said, that these claims are moot because the appellants already pursued their adequate remedy at law. Now
Which was the stay,
and they had two different appeals. They had the extraordinary writ. They've raised these issues back in 2009 when the rates were being charged, and they failed to meet the standard, not only because they failed to post a bond, but because they also, in our opinion at least, failed to establish a likelihood of success on the merits of those arguments. But they certainly had their adequate remedy at law and pursued that. And I would also like to briefly make a point on the remedy with this retroactive issue, Your Honor.
Well, Counsel, you're already substantially over your time.
Okay. I'll... Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Grady, you've saved a minute.
Thank you, Your Honor. Very quickly, on the mootness issue, Your Honor, there is an exception to mootness where an issue is capable of yet repetition, yet evading review. We believe this falls directly within that. We contend that a stay was not an adequate remedy of law here. Why? Because the commission's order was issued in March of 2008. The final order was issued from which an appeal could run not until November. That was 8 months into a nine-month collection period. There is no way that that stay could have been issued. An appeal needed to come with the stay. That's why we filed a writ of prohibition in April of 2009 to stop it. So I would contend that there was not an adequate remedy law available. And very quickly on the Black-Scholes, on the shopping issue, the commission could have ordered a cost-based model for POLA. There's nothing in the law that would have precluded that. In addition, the Black-Scholes model really was not an appropriate model. It was a it is a coal futures pricing option and not an option to it's never been used to evaluate the provider of last resort risk. And finally, that the best evidence here was just not good enough. There was no linkage between the actual shopping and the $456 million charged to customers. Thank you.
Thank you. Take the matter under consideration. You will be informed of our opinion. Our next case